Charles Lucky Luciano, the number one gangster of all time. Intelligent, ruthless, and a visionary. Luciano transformed the mafia from warring street gangs into a highly sophisticated empire. Under Luciano, the mafia grew to be bigger than General Motors. And by the time he'd finished, the mob was raking in $40 billion a year.
Lucky Luciano is a quintessential American. Using his cunning and his intelligence, rises to a position of fantastic power and wealth.
This is the story of the man who put the organized into organized crime.
One man changed the whole texture and landscape of crime in America. There's no question that Luciano invented the modern mafia.
But where were the law enforcers? Why was nobody able to stop him? On September the 10th, 1931, four hitmen came calling at offices above Grand Central Station in New York City. Their target, New York's top mafia boss, Salvatore Maranzano. This execution was a critical moment in the meteoric rise of the biggest gangster in American history. Charles Lucky Luciano.
Once in every generation comes along a dynamic criminal genius mind. And the mafia in America was blessed that they had Lucky Luciano.
Luciano had begun his career as a top hitman for New York Mafia Don Giuseppe Joe the Boss Masseria. Masseria headed the largest Italian gang in the city and ruled the streets in the early 1920s. But in 1925, another boss arrived in town. His name was Salvatore Maranzano, from the infamous mafia town of Castellammare del Golfo in Sicily. And he was eager to seize control of Masseria's empire. When tensions mounted between the two leaders, the killings began. The streets of New York turned red. The underworld called it the Castellammarese War. But for one man, all this chaos was the opportunity he was waiting for. Luciano had always been against the bloodbath, arguing that gunfights and bodies were bad for business and attracted too much police attention. Luciano also despised the old ways of his warring boss, Masseria. Luciano wanted to build bridges with Jewish and Irish gangsters. He believed their networks were essential to the success of the mafia's international businesses. But Masseria was fiercely opposed to any non-Italian partnerships.
People like Masseria hardly spoke English. They couldn't communicate. It was a different generation. And Lucky understood this, and they didn't.
After 18 months of fighting, with no end in sight, Maranzano told Luciano that if Masseria was eliminated, he would not take revenge on his men. Luciano shared Maranzano's vision and made him an offer. He would kill his boss, Masseria, if he could take over his gang and become an equal power with Maranzano. Maranzano accepted the deal. Luciano invited Masseria to a lunchtime meeting at one of his favorite restaurants, the Nova Villa Tamaro, in Coney Island, New York. While they played cards, Luciano's hitman waited outside for his signal. Masseria's murder, Luciano signaled to the underworld that the Castellamarese War was over. Maranzano then called hundreds of gang members from across the country to a meeting in the Bronx to announce his victory.
"Now it's going to be different,"
he told them, and spelled out his grand plan. The gangs of New York would be organized into five families to control the boroughs of the Bronx, Brooklyn, Manhattan, Queens, and Staten Island. Each family would be headed by a boss with an underboss, and under them would be lieutenants and soldiers. And above them all would be Maranzano himself. And if anyone disagreed, they would be killed.
"I'm going to be capo di tutti capi, the boss of all bosses."
This meant that he would be the leader of all the New York Mafia operations. His speech enraged Luciano. Maranzano had backtracked on his promise of equality, and now Luciano was determined to strike back. Maranzano realized Luciano was a potential threat to his total dominance of the American Mafia. So Maranzano contracted the notorious Irish killer, Vincent Mad Dog Cole, to get rid of Luciano. Cole was a lone, out-of-town hitman for hire and would be perfect for the job. But Luciano learned the details of the plan. Maranzano would call him into his office for a business meeting, and Mad Dog Cole would be waiting there to kill him. For Luciano, it was now a question of kill or be killed. The problem was how to kill Maranzano. He was extremely well protected, never without bodyguards, and always traveled in a bulletproof car. Tax agents and accountants were frequent visitors to Maranzano's offices, and Luciano realized that this was his way in. On the day Luciano was to have his meeting with Maranzano, he would send his hitmen instead, all posing as taxmen. As an extra touch, they would be Jewish, as he knew Maranzano despised them. Luciano then contacted his childhood friend, Maya Lansky, to arrange the hit. It is said that Lansky then rented a remote house in the Bronx for the four killers to prepare for the hit. They were forbidden to leave the house and were provided with all the provisions they required, including women. And through the summer months of 1931, Lansky taught them how to talk, walk, and act like taxmen. Then in September, the call came through. Maranzano told Luciano to come to his office to discuss urgent business. On September the 10th, 1931, Luciano sent the four hitmen to Maranzano's offices above Grand Central Station in New York. Gangsters entered his office and drew their knives, a weapon chosen to kill their victim in silence. But Maranzano would not go down without a fight. He took multiple stab wounds to his body, a slashed throat, and was still alive. Killers were forced to do it the noisy way. With the death of Maranzano, Luciano's time had come. At last, Luciano would realize his vision to reach out across America and organize organized crime. One of the first people he turned to was someone he'd known since they were both street kids. Luciano started out by offering protection to Jewish schoolboys targeted by Irish gangs. One day, he squared up to a small boy on his way home.
If you want to keep alive, Jew boy, you gotta pay us 5 cents a week protection money.
The schoolboy stared him in the eye and told him to
go fuck yourself.
It was Maya Lansky, a young Polish immigrant and the man who Luciano had turned to when he needed hitmen for Maranzano's execution.
From day one, we're talking when they're in their early teens, they knew each other. They were thugs then. But they developed this relationship where they built it into an empire.
Maya Lansky became Luciano's right-hand man and chief business executive. He was tough, brilliant with numbers, and, unusually for a mobster, honest.
The relationship between Lucky Luciano and Maya Lansky is the most important relationship in organized crime in the United States.
Critically, Lansky was able to do complex calculations in his head without committing anything to paper.
These are two incredibly talented and open-minded individuals who realized that if they joined forces using an American corporation as a model, that they could eliminate the possibility of an individual monopolizing profits, and they could share profits and distribute them evenly, and therefore bring a certain stability to organized crime that had never existed before.
And there was another Jewish gangster to get Luciano to think big. Arnold Rothstein. Known along Broadway as the brain, the big bankroll, and the fixer, Rothstein was a fabulously rich New York businessman.
There were things that Rothstein was doing that nobody else was doing, and Luciano saw the possibilities.
Rothstein could bring off rackets that no one else could dream of.
Arnold Rothstein was famous as the man who fixed the 1919 World Series. This is a prime example of racketeering. You take a normal activity like a baseball game, you corrupt the players, therefore you can bet on a winning thing.
Rothstein tutored him there about how real money could be made, not just in low-level predatory street crime, that there were bigger things, you could fix things.
And sure enough, bigger things were about to come along for Luciano. In 1919, the U.S. government did an incredible thing. It banned alcohol, believing that it was leading to the moral destruction of the nation. The ban was known as Prohibition, and with America wanting to drink, it was a gift to organized crime gangs, especially in the thirstiest cities like New York.
They saw a real gold mine in Prohibition. And what it did was it turned some of them, like Luciano, they had to become executives. Because now they had to run organizations that either imported a booze or manufactured it, and you had to distribute it. So in that sense, they had to run a real organization. It wasn't just go out and mug somebody on the street. You had to be smart now, because you were dealing, instead of thousands, you were dealing with millions. So it turned these people who were really inexperienced, old-fashioned outlaws into business criminal executives overnight.
Luciano, Lansky, and Rothstein proved to be quick learners, and soon they became very rich indeed.
Now that wealth translates into power. It translates into political power. It means that you can buy political protection. It means that you can buy police protection, because alcohol is something everybody wants to do. So they are willing to collude with gangsters. What they don't understand is that once you cooperate with gangsters, you've sold your soul. And the gangsters understood this.
With New York City full of booze, and cops, judges, and council officials being bribed all over the place, Luciano and his associates had free rein to take control of whatever they wanted.
They had their hand in everything because nobody would look at them. Nobody would even consider investigating them. Not the least of which was J. Edgar Hoover.
There is nothing mysterious about the manner in which the Federal Bureau of Investigation works. A special agent must be a good marksman and have the courage to shoot it out with the most venomous of public enemies.
Director Hoover supervising field practice.
And J. Edgar Hoover was the boss of the FBI, and he was eager to make a name for himself.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation, the paramount law enforcement, and the only national law enforcement agency that could really combat the mafia, and they didn't do a thing.
Hoover had launched his war on crime during the early 1930s. He went after bank robbers, kidnappers, and killers who were terrorizing the Midwest and outraging the nation.
The FBI mostly went after the headline public enemies like John Dillinger, Pretty Boy Floyd.
Machine Gun Kelly, taking people out with, you know.
Hoover had essentially denied that there was a national crime syndicate. He said these are local gangsters and this is the job of the local police to deal with them. He didn't want to get involved with these people because they're very well connected politically.
Realizing nobody was going to come after him, Luciano was able to expand his vision and develop new ways for the mafia to grow.
Luciano saw and could predict that by the late 20s, Prohibition was going to end in America.
If the mafia was going to be successful, Luciano had to prevent inter-mob wars from ever breaking out again.
It was terrible for business, and it also threw a spotlight on him. That's why I say he was something like a Bill Gates or a Warren Buffett, and he had to get a different business model.
So, Towards the end of 1931, Luciano summoned the top leaders of 20 mafia factions across the country, including gangsters like Al Capone, to a national conference in Chicago. Luciano then did an extraordinary thing. He proposed an entirely new business structure for organized crime.
He laid out the rules. Here's how we're going to operate. This whole concept that had never existed before, he created a whole new texture, a whole new way of how criminals could operate in America, organized criminals. What he did was he turned predatory street gangs, which had many internal and external wars with each other, he turned them into this one single octopus of an organization that was so different from anything else that ever existed. And it took the American law enforcement almost 60 years to get a handle on it. It was so terrific.
Luciano kept with Maranzano's five New York families, but to each family, he added a consigliere, a skilled counselor and advisor, whose task was to ensure that problems within families were resolved without the need for violence. Luciano then unveiled his most striking innovation without precedent in the Sicilian mafia or amongst American gangsters.
Luciano, he created the commission, and the commission would be the board of directors. If any rules for the mafia throughout the country had to be changed, it would be up to the commission. And if there were any territorial disputes or disputes over rackets, the commission would take care of it. Now, the concept there was to prevent wars.
It is almost precisely what the various countries around the world did when they were faced with the same problem post-World War II. They created the United Nations. One could actually take the UN Charter and, for most of it, substitute the word families for states and Cosa Nostra for the organization for the United Nations and Commission for Security Council, and the rules would be identical.
As proof of his good intentions, Luciano introduced one other startling change. He would be just one amongst equals. There would be no boss of all bosses. Instead, Luciano introduced a more democratic form of leadership. The commission would consist of a board of seven family directors, five in New York, and one each in both Chicago and Buffalo. Each would have a single vote with all the decisions determined by the majority. This would ensure all the leaders of the most powerful families had an equal say.
He was this incredible, dynamic genius who saw how the landscape and how the tapestry of the mafia had to be organized. Here is somebody who comes along in 1931 and envisions that if the mafia was going to prevail and succeed, it had to be a mirror image of American capitalism.
Luciano had come up with a business structure. It would last for the next 50 years. And because it worked so perfectly, everything was now up for grabs.
But the commission was the second government of this country. It really was. They actually controlled a lot of industries in this country, not the least of which was the restaurant business. Gambling industry. Las Vegas is a great example of it.
They had control of the garment industry, the meat industry, the fish market, the docks, the unions, loan sharking, drugs and prostitution.
Luciano said he was going to turn prostitution into an industry like the A&P. Which is a supermarket chain.
They were all powerful.
And and they were making billions of dollars a year. And what was good for the mafia was good for Luciano, too.
By 1930 standards, Lucky Luciano wasn't even a multimillionaire anymore, he was a billionaire.
Luciano took a suite in one of the most luxurious hotels in the world, the Waldorf Astoria, and checked in under the name of Charles Ross to protect himself from rival gangsters.
The kind of money he was reaping in millions every week, and he suddenly became a really sharp dresser. Had ladies on his arms all the time, had a private plane. He flew around to racetracks all over the country.
Luciano was also a bachelor and party animal. He rose late, wore handmade suits and shoes from England, and danced the nights away with chorus girls and nightclub singers.
And he operated in this kind of almost open fashion as this suave, debonair type who could roam around New York, nightclubs, he had pieces of everything.
Luciano wined and dined with politicians and rubbed shoulders with stars like Frank Sinatra and the actor of many classic gangster films, George Raft. Luciano's high life was getting him noticed elsewhere. FBI agents began to work out that he was a key player in the underworld, but they had surprisingly little information on him. One statement described Luciano as the leading racketeer along Italian lines, is very powerful, and made considerable money in liquor. Another declared, Charles Luciano, alias Lucky, is the head of the underworld in New York. And an FBI memo had Luciano in a conspiracy to smuggle drugs from Europe into the United States. They also had in their hands local police records, which showed Luciano had been arrested 35 times for offenses ranging from traffic violations to assault and robbery with a gun. Despite this evidence, the FBI still decided to ignore him. But there was a man determined to get Luciano. His name was Thomas E. Dewey.
We have made a real start on cleaning the gangsters out of New York.
Dewey was a fiercely ambitious lawyer who, by the age of just 33, had got the top job as New York City's special prosecutor to crack down on organized crime.
In 2 years, we have shown that our people can be protected, that they can be delivered from the grip of the mob.
In the 1930s, Luciano was the face of organized crime.
It was an open secret how important and how big he was.
And Dewey was after him. He realized that Luciano must be making vast sums of money from his criminal enterprises to finance his luxurious lifestyle.
Today, crime is syndicated and organized. A new type of criminal exists who leaves to his hirelings and frontmen the actual offenses and rarely commits an overt act himself. The only way in which the major criminal can be punished is by connecting him to those various layers.
But Dewey had a tough time finding anything he could pin on him. Luciano was careful with every step he took. He was wary of wiretaps, cautious with his telephone conversations, and like his close friend, Meyer Lansky, kept no records on paper. All the incriminating details were in his head. Then, out of the blue, Dewey was offered a lead that could ensnare Luciano in a web of vice crime. A series of police wiretaps in local brothels uncovered clues that an organization called the Combine controlled around 300 establishments in Manhattan and Brooklyn. They discovered that a top Luciano enforcer named David Little Davy Battillo was overseeing the Combine operations. In January 1936, Dewey's investigators raided 80 brothels in the New York City area and arrested over 100 prostitutes and madams.
These arrested women were definitely placed between a rock and a hard place. They had nowhere to go.
The cops started to put the women under real pressure to spill the beans on Luciano.
So many of them were addicted to heroin when they were arrested. Cops waited until the fourth day of the cold turkey withdrawal when they were climbing the walls and desperate to get them to agree to testify against the mob.
Dewey's investigators managed to get three or four people to flip, to turn. And incredibly, they claimed that they had seen Luciano at meetings where he discussed what kind of percentage his family was getting from these whorehouses.
Even before the trial had commenced, the newspapers had Luciano convicted. The New York Daily News headlined him the droopy-eyed czar of the oldest profession. The trial began on May the 12th, 1935. Dewey reined forth in his opening statement.
Luciano will be shown not to have placed any of the women in houses or taken money from them. Instead, he set up his apartment in the Waldorf Astoria and was the czar of the ring. We will show that Luciano's function was to rule. All other defendants were his servants.
Dewey lined up 68 witnesses, mainly hookers, pimps, and madams, who had been promised shorter sentences, immunity, or probation from aiding the prosecution. Dewey's main strategy was to depict the prostitutes as desperate victims of the Depression, exploited and terrorized by the Combine's ruthless enforcers.
The madam who was hit over the head with the lead stick, for example, went on the witness stand to testify that there was blood all over the place when she was attacked by the very men who were sitting there in the defendant's area.
One of the key witnesses was the notorious madam, Cokie Flo.
Cokie Flo's testimony was typical of the testimony that all of the women gave on the witness stand. It was hearsay. She heard Luciano was going to bring everybody together like a chain of supermarkets. She heard this and she heard that.
The idea that he would discuss in the presence of prostitutes, even a madam, the kind of mundane business stuff just didn't work. It looked like a fix. They got these witnesses to really exaggerate or to invent testimony.
At this stage in the trial, with doubt being cast over the evidence, everything seemed to be going in Luciano's favor. But then, Luciano made a big mistake. Against his lawyer's advice, he insisted on taking to the witness stand to deny all charges.
Dewey's demeanor while interviewing Lucky Luciano, while Luciano was under oath on the witness stand, was very brilliant. He got him to show his underworld side, the side that wasn't very funny to most people, wasn't very suave or sophisticated to others.
For 4 hours, Dewey pummeled him with questions about his life his previous convictions, his taxes, his association with other gangsters, and proved that he was lying in answer after answer.
He was really lacerated by Dewey's questioning.
I am asking you, do you tell the truth when you are under oath?
I'm telling the truth now.
You don't want to answer that question, do you?
I didn't say I told the truth all the time, but now I'm telling the truth.
Dewey's onslaught had now reduced Luciano to a perspiring, squirming wreck. Far from being an honest businessman, he was revealed as a tax evader.
You have not paid a dime to the state government yet, is that right?
That's right.
And that is because the federal state prosecutes big gangsters and the state does not by income tax. Isn't that so?
I don't know.
Dewey even brought out information, very embarrassing to Luciano, that he had once, when he was a young man, had been an informer in a narcotics investigation. So it made his whole reputation look a little tainted. Here was this top guy. Turned out that once he had been a rat to save his skin.
In the end, Dewey's summation to the jury described Luciano's testimony as
a shocking, disgusting display of sanctimonious perjury, at the end of which I am sure not one of you had a doubt that before you stood not a gambler, not a bookmaker, but the greatest gangster in America.
And Dewey managed to persuade the jury to the end. Luciano was convicted on 62 counts of compulsory prostitution. Justice McCook gave the sentence.
I am not here to reproach you, but since there is no excuse for your conduct nor for your rehabilitation to administer adequate sentence, I hereby pronounce a sentence to serve from 30 to 50 years.
The sentence probably did not fit the crime, but it was an instrument on the part of Dewey and the prosecutor's office to try to rid New York of the elements of organized crime that were the most threatening.
Dewey was a crime-busting hero, and it was the start of his meteoric career. He became the governor of New York in 1942 and twice ran for presidency.
Once the alliance between criminals and politicians is smashed, racketeering will come to a prompt end.
In his memories of the case, Luciano wrote,
I still get madder at Dewey's crap more than anything else. That little shit with the mustache comes right out and admits he got me for everything else but what he charged me with. He knew I didn't have a fucking thing to do with prostitution, not with none of them broads. But Dewey was such a goddamn racketeer himself, in a legal way, that he crawled up my back with a frame and stabbed me.
Luciano tried to fight back. He appealed against his sentence. And he ordered for the prostitutes who testified against him to be rounded up so they could now say they had lied in court.
They met up with the mobsters, all is forgiven kind of mentality, and re-addicted to heroin almost immediately. Once they were re-addicted, they brought them cross-country to offices in California, signed briefs that they were rescinding their prior testimony and that they did not mean it, that they told a bunch of lies.
Despite his efforts, Luciano's appeal failed. Luciano was sent to the isolated maximum security Clinton Penitentiary in Dannemora, near the Canadian border. Nicknamed Siberia, it was 500 miles away and a far cry from the luxurious trappings of his Manhattan life.
What a come down from a suite at the Waldorf Towers to a cell.
When they told me I was going to Dannemora, I wasn't sure I could make it. It meant moving out of the Waldorf Towers into a sewer. The worst part of it was, we didn't have any connections up there, and that meant I was in for a rough time. I was willing to put up a $1 million bond, and I told them that as soon as I heard that I was going to Dannemora. But once they had me, they wasn't gonna let me go.
But anyone who thought Luciano was finished was mistaken. His foresight in setting up the commission now showed itself.
When he was sentenced, the family didn't dissolve. The organization continued to function. And this is, again, the wisdom of Lucky Luciano, that even though he, the originator, is the first boss to be convicted, he proves his point. It functions well.
Although Luciano remained the boss, Frank Costello, a highly regarded and well-known figure in New York's underworld, took over the day-to-day running of his empire. And Costello continued to bring in millions of dollars and increase the family's fortunes while his boss planned his next move. And Luciano didn't have to wait long. When America entered the Second World War in 1942, he found that his country needed him. The war in the Atlantic was going badly for the Allies. And the US government was concerned their crucial East Coast docks were under serious threat.
It's the keystone to the war effort on the East Coast. One ship, a French ship in Normandy, caught on fire and sank.
Sparked by an acetylene torch, swept through the proud ship. Thousands of workmen fled for their lives as firemen from all parts of New York and neighboring cities fought the fire around the world.
The prevailing opinion is that it was accidental, but the U.S. Navy and a lot of other government officials believed it could have been sabotage.
Naval intelligence, desperate to prevent further attacks and German spies from infiltrating the docks, sought the help of the mobsters who controlled the waterfronts. But if they were going to get the help of the dockers, they had to get the mafia's permission first.
Luciano was so powerful that the mafia bosses would not consent. These are not patriots. They're not stepping up to the government and saying, yes, sir, and saluting. They're saying, we have to get approval from the boss, our boss. Our boss is not the president of the United States. Our boss is Lucky Luciano, and he's in prison.
To win Luciano's support, the first thing the U.S. government did was move Luciano from the harsh conditions of Dannemora to a prison known as the Country Club of the Penal System, Grand Meadow, close to New York. Here, Luciano began negotiations with the authorities and his men.
And sure enough, Luciano acts like he's a patriot now, even though he was still an Italian citizen and never a naturalized American citizen. And he sends out the word through Lansky and other couriers, peace on the waterfront. Not only would there be no sabotage, there would be no work stoppages. Things were going to run smoothly. It's the word from the boss. What an example. A man in prison has so much power that he could control the essential harbor in New York City. If you need any testimonial to his power, that's it.
Luciano then asked for a pardon. He had delivered his side of the bargain and now wanted freedom.
Guess who's the governor of New York at that time? No other person but Thomas E. Dewey.
In an extraordinary irony, Dewey, the man who put him away for 30 to 50 years, granted Luciano executive clemency in 1946 on the condition that he was deported to Italy and that he would never be allowed back in the U.S. Dewey's resentment was clear.
Upon the entry of the United States into the war, Luciano's aid was sought by the armed services in inducing others to provide information concerning possible enemy attack. It appears that he cooperated in such an effort, although the actual value of the information produced is not clear.
Luciano had served just 10 years of his 50-year sentence when he left American shores on February the 10th, 1946, bound for Sicily. But within months, Luciano was traveling from Italy to Havana, Cuba, and was back in business. A week-long meeting was held at the Hotel Nacional, where Luciano, Meyer Lansky, Frank Costello, and other high-ranking mafia members discussed the heroin trade.
He was involved in numerous narcotics deals because Italy at that time was really becoming important in the transfer of narcotics, not just to the U.S., but worldwide. Heroin was becoming a big moneymaker for the mafia.
In 1957, in Palermo, Sicily, Luciano was reported to be overseeing meetings with more than 30 Sicilian and American mafia leaders to create the world's largest heroin exporting rackets. Five years later, in 1962, Luciano was targeted for arrest as an alleged member of a ring that smuggled $150 million worth of heroin into the United States. But before the authorities could get him, Luciano died of a heart attack in Italy. He was 65.
A guy who could demand respect. Luciano was the power to be. He ran the show, willing to resort to violence if he had to. And the system worked. I mean, the guy was good.
Charles Lucky Luciano's reign had been a remarkable one. He transformed the mafia from the warring street gangs into a highly sophisticated empire. Under Luciano, the mafia grew to be bigger than General Motors. And by the time he'd finished, the mob was raking in $40 billion a year. And while there had been run-ins with the local law enforcement agencies, the FBI hadn't even known it existed. And if anyone likes to think of Luciano as a criminal genius, they should not forget that he had many people killed, condemned many others to drug addiction and prostitution, and left a terrible wake of misery and suffering behind him.